Hey everyone, time to kick off another exciting edition of our DevOps Office Hours. It's April 12th, 2023. I'm Eric Osterman, founder and CEO of Cloud Posse, and I'll be your host today. Cloud Posse is the DevOps accelerator. We help companies conquer AWS using our proven blueprints for AWS. We're so confident in our results that we offer money-back guarantee. So if you're starting from scratch or just not happy with your current setup, head to cloudposse.com/quiz to book a session with me, and I'll show you what your future can look like starting right now. If you're new here, don't worry. Our format's super informal. My goal is to answer your questions. If you're curious about Cloud Posse or any of our open source tools and modules, this is a great place to ask. For those of us joining us through our podcast or YouTube channel, we host these calls every week, so don't miss out. You can register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Our call today is recorded. We'll be automatically posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. So if you want to help us out in what we do over here, please hit those like and subscribe buttons. Just go to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. So with that said, got a bunch of exciting announcements for this week. One is if you're using Atmos, we added the ability to have log levels. This is helpful if you want to kind of limit the amount of output. Historically, we were kind of drowning the screen with lots of output, and it also made it harder to parse the output from Terraform and so forth. So that is now hidden behind various log levels, info, debug, trace, and so forth. We also support logging that to a file and expect more DX improvements to Atmos in the coming weeks as we're knocking off some of the low-hanging fruit we've been putting off. Next announcement is if you're looking what to do next in your career, and security is one of those, there's a new training curriculum from the NSA that's free, hundreds of hours of training on various areas that you can start to study up on. I think it's just that there's such a dearth of SecOps professionals out there that they're trying to make it more accessible. So check that out. This one is somewhat near and dear to my heart. Before we had Atmos, we were using Make extensively. Make has been around for decades. And if you started, back in the day with things like the Linux kernel, you've undoubtedly used a lot of Make at some point. Hey, if you could build complex projects with Make, why not build infrastructure the same way? And that's how we were thinking about it. It worked for a long time until it didn't. The biggest problem that we found is that, when you start creating a framework on top of Make to build your projects, it becomes almost impossible to understand what's going on. It's just passing environment variables all over the place. You don't know what consumes those environment variables. The debugging abilities within Make are difficult. There's been a lot of other opportunities now, a lot of other projects that have come up like GoTask, Mage, Atmos, and others that reinvent Make in some ways. So this here is taking GNU Make, re-implementing Go, and adding tracing capabilities. So if you're using Make and heavily invested in it, maybe this is a good alternative if you're struggling with the scale of managing your Make files. Has anyone tried Remake already? All right. Then the next announcement is something. I thought this was announced at HashiConf, or maybe it's just now reached GA or general availability, but for the longest time, we've been relying on external secrets operator, third-party operator supports lots of secrets backends, 1Password, SSM, ASM, HashiCorp Vault. Well, HashiCorp has appropriately enough come out with their own operator now for Kubernetes, so you can synchronize secrets out of Vault into your cluster. So you can keep the proprietariness of Vault out of your applications and deployment. So your applications can still continue to consume secrets as environment variables or files or however you wish. So check that out. Next one was something that kind of slid under my radar. I guess this came out earlier this year in January, but HashiCorp has been open sourcing a lot of their internal tooling that they've built. One of those is Hermes, and Hermes is a way, I guess, more efficiently to manage your documentation. I'm a little bit confused because it still is based on top of Google Docs or uses a lot of Google Docs. But one of the things you don't get with Google Docs is a like approval process. So you don't know the state of various documents and whether you know they've been reviewed, published, et cetera. So I think that's one of the things that this adds on top of it. All right. Anyone know more about this than me? Which wasn't a lot. All right. TF Target. So I saw this via the a weekly TF newsletter. This is neat. I like it. You know, Teraliths are still the norm as much as they've been, made a taboo. Teraliths are, of course, where you have very large root modules. Those root modules call lots of other child modules. And the problem is when you work with a Teralith, every time you run plan, you're planning the entire state. And every time you apply, you're applying the entire state. You can get smart by using the target argument, but now you need to know the paths of all your resources. And that's not really that friendly. So this is a cool little utility where it runs the plan and then, through some regex expressions or something, extracts what the actual resources are, gives you a friendly little selector to select which ones you actually want to target in your apply. And there you go. No more having to resolve resource paths. So I see this as a way of maybe more safely doing rollouts perhaps in monoliths, or sometimes in a monolith, you actually have to only deploy some resources first before the others. I forget when we've had to do this, but I know we've had to do that like for migrations or something. Matt, any thing come to mind also when we use target?
Not particularly that, but TF target plan, if your infrastructure is sufficiently big enough, go run some errands, go to the grocery store, come back, have a couple cups of coffee, then you'll be presented with your list of things that you can select and then go and do it. I think that's the problem with like these giant like Teralists is that they take forever to plan. But then the other thing is obviously this tool in particular is only useful for interactive deployments, like no sort of CI/CD or anything along those lines, which also is kind of an anti-pattern well. Like it's neat, but it's like all these neat things like.
You should be
full of anti-patterns. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with the aforementioned, the concerns that. But at least it has that nice little spinner. So while you're waiting the 2 hours for your plan to run, you know it's still running.
Assuming TF target takes the dash timeout and you remember to send it. Because then, you'll walk away thinking it's going to take forever and then it'll time out after 10 minutes, I think, which is the default. So
the next announcement was a small one, AppRunner, which is one of Amazon's 15 ways to build, deploy, and run containers, has finally added some more instance types. Previously, they were limited to two cores and two cores and up to 4 gigs of RAM, I believe, yep. And then now you can get up to 4 CPUs and 12 gigs of RAM. So I'm curious, Pepe, are you here? No, you're not here today. you know, is it finally big enough, powerful enough that we can run something simple like Atlantis in App Runner for a simple deployment model to get GitOps? Yeah. Verdict's
out. So big your infrastructure is.
Yeah. Because I know it was poo-pooed when it was on the smaller size here. That wouldn't fail for a lot. But I'm guessing this will satisfy majority of users of Terraform with this. All right. Last announcement, only because last week you just got finished upgrading your EKS clusters to 1.25. Thought I'd share some good news that 1.26 is out now, but it looks like I have the wrong URL here. Or they changed the URL. Vlad just shared that with me a little while ago. Yeah. Anyways, that's what I got. Anyone else have some more announcements? That's interesting. Here's somebody journaling their experience upgrading between every major version of Kubernetes or minor version of Kubernetes. Share that. No more announcements? All right. Well, let's jump into Q&A.
I was just going to mention one quick thing before we go there. Like two, not last night, but the night before, I installed like the latest Mac, whatever patch for my operating system, update for my operating system. And yesterday during the day, logged in and started doing some work. A little while later, came back and, long story short, my entire PAM subsystem was just hosed and I couldn't like log in or do anything. I couldn't run sudo, couldn't log in after I rebooted, did a whole bunch of things, and I ended up having to like rescue recover like my Mac and reset back to factory settings. But big shout out to the fact that maybe about 3 months ago or 4 months ago, I put a lot of effort into getting most of my config codified via Nix, and it only took me about 2.5 hours to get my entire MacBook back, including restoring all my data back from S3, which was like pretty cool. So
very cool.
That exact same thing happened to me 2 days ago. The exact same thing. I ultimately had to boot, reinstall, and go from a Time Machine backup that I luckily had from like 2 days prior. But yeah.
So right. I looked to see if I was eligible for updates on my Mac OS, and I am. And I am going to opt out.
That's why I wanted to put it out there. It seemed like I Googled it. I didn't really find anything about it. But
yeah, there was nothing out there. Happened. I couldn't log in. It was really odd. It was odd. It wouldn't boot in a single mode, user mode. It just kept coming up locked. It was weird.
What version was that? 13.3.1?
Yeah, Ventura, the latest Ventura.
And you folks are using the M1 or the Intel-based chipset?
I have an M1.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Good to know. appreciate you guys sharing. Quick question for you, Matt, since we're on the Q&A section. How is Nix working out for you? Because right now, on my team, we're using very Dockerized, containerized. Like, we've just gotten a Docker file, we load it up, and yeah, we've been doing that. It's been working out okay. We also use GitHub Codespaces, which works out well for us. But I've heard about Nix multiple times in the past few months, today here, as well as through local meetups. So it seems to be gaining more popularity.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say, to be fair, a couple of things. One, I've only really used it to configure and run my local environment, and also a jump host I have that runs in AWS. So I have a common Nix config for most of that, and then one's Linux and one's Mac. So there's variations between the two of those. What I will say is that I was praising Nix like crazy yesterday when I had to restore this. And all the little things that you just don't remember, like all the, you know, the settings in your Finder to show hidden files, and you know, the way that you like your background to look, and how long you want your screensaver to wait before it comes on, and like all these little like stupid things that took me forever to track down how to set them in Nix. I was really like happy that I did. That being said, I will say like the Nix learning curve kind of looks like a 90 degree angle. It is definitely not, you know, and obviously that's coming from someone who has tons of experience in, you know, a lot of different DevOps tools and a lot of development tools, and you know, all of it, and I've used, you know, Ansible and Salt and Puppet and, you know, whatever over the Terraform, obviously, over the years. And I just felt like a lot of the concepts were really hard to grok, and their documentation for newbies like getting started kind of sucks in my opinion, but I found a couple of good YouTube videos of guys who explained it pretty well, and then that actually helped me like get it set in my mind space. And then once I kind of got it set in my mind space, I was able to kind of do what I needed to do. But it was a lot of effort to get up and running and to get everything codified, but since I've done that, I've been much happier. And like obviously in this, you know, building a new laptop was the ultimate reason that you would need it that way. And it worked really, really well for me. So that's my long answer to your short question.
I've heard Nix is fantastic. I haven't used it myself. I'm using a tool called DevBox, which basically uses Nix, but it's a simpler interface. DevBox gives you most of the benefits of a container. It's not a container. I posted a thing on the chat channel. So if you want to dip your toes into Nix, I would suggest checking out DevBox for a bit. And if you need the extra power that Nix gives you, then you have an on-ramp.
Yeah, there's also, I think this is it. Now I have to find... I have to find it, but there's also I'm forgetting the name right now. It's like My Nix something, and it's a website that basically gives you like a wizard kind of over Nix, and it basically will generate your Nix files and a bunch of other stuff for you. I'm trying to see if I, that's it. It's mynixos.com. If you want to pop that in here, it's pretty cool. Like you can go through and actually say like, I want to create a new like flake. And then it will ask you all the things like, what are your inputs? What are your outputs? Like, and it has choices for all these things, and people can share all of their configs like through here as well. So it's kind of like a central repository. If you sign up, and you can sign up with GitHub, and it's like, they have a free version and then they have like two tiers of paid versions. Personally, once I started down this path, and then what I realized was that if I still didn't understand like what the hell was going on with it, like this wasn't all that helpful, but I saw a lot of people recommending it. Maybe it was just me that my brain just couldn't get around it until I understood like how Nix was working like in general. But like I said, it was a couple, you know, a few months ago that I took the leap to get all my stuff in it. And I'm really happy that I did, given what happened a couple nights ago. So
was this was then totally, you had coincidentally just been doing this even before Jeremy did his internal presentation.
Yeah. I've been kicking the tires on it for a while. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well,
hi, sorry I'm a bit late.
Well, yeah, not for today, but given the interest, maybe we'll schedule one in a couple of weeks. We'll do a quick Nixos demo and do what we basically did on an internal show and tell. I think that'd benefit everyone. All right. Anything? Yeah. Any other questions?
My main reason of mentioning it was just that I think there's something up with the latest Mac, you know, patch release. So I want everyone to be careful and make sure they have backups and everything before they apply it. That was like the thing. And then I also got psyched that I could restore quickly.
I have a question.
Go for it.
I am wondering if anyone here has used Keycloak to manage their, you know, authorization and authentication for your API. What are your thoughts, observations around it?
I'll give our experience. Now, this is a little bit dated as of 2 years ago, because we stopped doing it 2 years ago or so, maybe even longer at this point. So Keycloak and Gatekeeper used to be integral cornerstones of the Cloud Posse reference architecture and what we delivered in every single engagement. It was the way we exposed your internal services behind like a identity aware proxy. It was how we didn't have to worry about what IDP you had because we could just connect it to Keycloak, end of story. We deploy it on a like centralized Kubernetes server in our corp account and deploy Keycloak and so forth. It also was really nice together with something called Foxel or Kubernetes. Is a little dashboard that lets you annotate your services and then expose them on a dashboard like this, so you can discover them easily and access them. It was actually because of Foxel, we wanted to do all this other stuff. We introduced Keycloak and Gatekeeper and so forth. All right, so Gatekeeper then was basically abandoned and changed hands like 5 times. And I think finally it came back to its own project and is Gatekeeper again, and everyone's happy. Keycloak, on the other hand, is a great product at what it does, incredibly feature rich. But when we tried to use it, the very inconsistent APIs on how to Terraform it itself and manage it with infrastructure as code, I'm guessing maybe that's improved in the last couple of years. It was a unfriendly product to manage with infrastructure as code. So we pretty much just deployed Keycloak the way you would deploy WordPress. Like you deploy it once and then you manage the rest of it once it's up and running, but didn't make me feel warm and fuzzy when we had to do major upgrades. It's in Java. And that means there's probably 10 more, you know, 0 days out there we still don't know about that are there. And it's in the critical path of all your authentication. There have been 0 days with Keycloak as well. So like this very important critical piece of how you do authorization, authentication, you know, between your services, maybe that's something worth paying for and not relying on open source if you can afford it.
That makes sense. That's helpful.
So anyone else share their experiences?
Yeah. I've never
used. Go ahead.
I was just going to quickly say I looked at Keycloak a couple years ago, around that same time frame of two to 3 years ago, and end up not using it for the same infrastructure management reasons that you just highlighted. Of it's, you can deploy it, and then after you deploy it, you kind of just back away from it. It's apparently very painful for day two operations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you're architecting it, looking at your applications and how you're going to run things and all of that, like authn and authz are two of the services that you should always consider outsourcing, because they are not easy to get right. They often have 0 day, as we were talking about, vulnerabilities and bugs that can be exploited. And if you get them wrong, the stakes are so high that, you know, it could literally be catastrophic to your company. So maybe look at that as outsourcing it to someone who, you know, who does this for a living, quote unquote, you know, and focus on, you know, the core 20% of things that are unique to your business. You know, I assure you, you're not adding any value by figuring out how to run that internally, other than maybe you're saving some dollars, but that could be like penny wise and pound foolish kind of thing.
Yeah. Auth0 gives you like 10,000 users free at some basic plan.
Yeah, I think it's 7,000 like monthly active users, and that's a lot. Like a lot of companies don't even ever reach that. So, especially if you're a startup, don't do it yourself.
Yeah.
I want to share my experience on KeyClock.
Go for it.
I'm currently running KeyClock in Kubernetes. I don't know if that's the route you're planning to go through. I can share one or two experience. It's somehow hard to, I would say, to upgrade or to maintain, if I would use that word. That is currently what I'm facing right now in using KeyClock. Use mchart to deploy KeyClock to Kubernetes, and using Ingress alongside to expose. However, when it comes to upgrading, we are currently having an issue where the previous deployment was using Postgres version 11, and trying to upgrade to 15 was a lot of headache. And we had to drop the database and have to, you know, start all over again. And it's a lot of issues. So if you can just, and I mean, go with Auth0 or have any other solution.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, it's weird because I think I'm in a position where the decision was already made to use this. And I'm going through the documentation, and you can often get a sense of how much headache something is going to be by how the documentation is laid out. And just wanted to get other people's opinions. So it's good to know what I have in store.
Yeah. That makes sense. Probably not a bad idea to put WAF or something in front of it too. Reduce some of the attack vectors from automated script kiddies going out there and exploiting KeyClock servers.
Great point. Thanks.
All right. So we're in the Q&A. Any questions? Did I miss something here in the Zoom chat?
I had one around upgrading EKS. So obviously 1.26 came out. We're trying to come up with some internal docs on just a good upgrade process for when we're using EKS, how we upgrade clusters. And so as I was working on this little project, ran into this weird issue where upgrading using Terraform just threw this weird config map error, but I can update in the UI and then I go back to my Terraform and I just update the version to what I had updated to, and everything's in sync and there's no issues. But if I try to trigger the update through, I believe it's a Cloud Posse EKS upgrade, the Cloud Posse EKS module, it just seems to have an issue. I wasn't sure if that was like a known practice where you go to the UI or use the CLI and you do the upgrade in that form, or if I've just got something weird in my environment. I just spun up a brand new cluster this morning when I was doing my testing.
Yeah, I haven't heard a report of it yet. I don't know of any customers that have upgraded to 1.26 yet. So,
okay. Yeah, no worries. It might just be something unique to my environment then.
The other thing that's often good, because a lot of the same problems we've had to solve for or encountered are also discussed in Terraform AWS modules. So let's see if they talk about any 1.26 issues.
But based off the silence, I'm assuming most of you folks just do it all through Terraform without issues.
Yeah, for the most part. I have heard of others sometimes having to use the UI for other reasons, but that's that.
Cool, no worries.
One of the considerations is also making sure you're upgrading. Well, first of all, what was the error you're getting again?
Let me just pull that up.
Because the other things that sometimes have to be upgraded alongside of it are some of the EKS add-ons, like the CNI and others.
Oh, actually, they're right in the Office Hours channel. It's a config map cannot get resource error config maps. AWS auth is forbidden. User system anonymous cannot get resource config maps in API group.
Oh, no, I think that's this other issue. How did you provision your EKS cluster? Were you using AWS SSO?
No, I actually did something really simple. I created a brand new AWS account, created a brand new IAM user, and no IAM roles or anything special. Very basic
user.
Passive use an IAM role. So I'm wondering if that might make a difference on this.
Say the last part again.
In the past, when I provisioned a cluster, I've usually done it using the IAM role. In this case, I've just done it as an IAM user, no roles or anything involved.
So using an IAM user in the web console and it works, and that same exact IAM user through Terraform and it doesn't work?
Yeah, I bootstrapped the cluster. Oh, sorry, I take that back. I used an IAM role in the UI because
was the cluster provisioned with Terraform, though?
The cluster was provisioned with Terraform with just the IAM user. And IAM user was created just within that AWS account, no role, no SIM role or anything like that.
Yeah, maybe one of the other team members would know. I just know there's lots of issues with EKS, right? Deploying it using...
It's owned by whoever you deploy it with. So I know that I specifically set up like an owner role that I use for that. And then in my Terraform, I switch to that when I'm doing stuff to it.
Yeah, I've had issues. Typically I was expecting that issue when I was doing it in the console. It was a little odd that it just let me do it. Yeah. It does throw errors elsewhere in the console when I try to access my cluster. But I can actually click the update button and it works. So I'm assuming there might be something going on behind the scenes after you click the update button.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it sounds like the person trying to update the config map doesn't have access, right?
Yeah, what's really odd is I'm using I just provisioned the 1.24 cluster. I was trying to go through a series of upgrade paths and tried to go to 1.25 and basically just got that error and then did 1.26 in the UI again because I was getting the same error with 1.25 to 1.26. And when I do a Terraform plan, it just shows up clean and even apply shows up clean. So the upgrades work. I just have to trigger it out of band outside of Terraform, which seems a little odd, but it might be I'm going down the less traveled path here of not using IAM role to provision this. There might be some weird edge case there.
Yeah, I know in our docs, we specifically call out you have to use a specific IAM role, similar to what I think Chris was saying.
Yeah, just whatever you provision it with, you need to update it with. It needs to be the same role in the Terraform.
Okay, cool.
Or you need to assume that role or something.
Yep. Yeah, it sounds like I should just follow the docs better. So let me go try that.
so that they weren't owned by people, I made like an owner role and the SSO roles can switch to that.
The one risk that, so in our docs, we say don't even use SSO roles because if you change those permission sets around, it'll create new roles, right? And then you might lose access to the role that the cluster was created or managed by.
Yeah, that's why I have an owner role. That's okay. SSO roles assume it. In the Terraform, I have another provisioner that switches. I create an owner role, and then I let that switch. I switch to that with another provisioner. I create the cluster, and then all the updates are under that owner role. And then the SSO roles can assume the owner role to do stuff.
Okay. That makes sense. You're doing.
And then I add the SSO roles into the config, into the AWS auth, which I think that's what you're trying to do to get the console access. Right.
Can you provision that owner role and then immediately use it to assume in the same Terraform? Do you, I,
I have one component. I use Atmos, and I have one that's like EKS owner role and one that's like EKS cluster. And it, and I use name, I use predictable naming patterns to tie it together, right? Not like the state or anything yet.
Got it. Cool. I think I know my problem. I'm just going off the normal path. So I'm going to try happy path and I'll probably get this to work. Thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Next question I see John Mary asking in the channel, has anyone implemented alerting on successful deployment rollout on Kubernetes with a customized message? I tried using KubeWatch, but it doesn't monitor for rollout, but for any change in deployment or pod, and also doesn't send customized messages. So how are you doing your deployments in general? And are you looking for some these messages to be triggered regardless of the path, meaning that somebody deployed something manually, somebody deployed something with Argo, somebody deployed something with Helm and GitHub Actions, all the same, you want a notification? Or do you have one specific like rollout strategy and you want to get a notification?
Yeah, so I have one specific rollout strategy. Basically, we are making use of GitHub Actions for the deployment. So I want to receive notification on the Slack channel to say like the pods are, the rollout is completed and everything is ready, because it's more like a blue green deployment where the new pods and the old pods are running concurrently till all the new pods are up and then the old ones are removed.
Hmm. Also, KubeWatch looks like it's been archived. Is that, has it moved?
Yeah, it's been archived for, yeah, the new one is this one on there. It's this Robusta, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't have an answer to be frank. No, our deployment notifications have been orchestrated using Argo CD and the notifications supported in there in Slack. Or we've used, you know, just a step in the GitHub Actions to send it. I think the path you're going is kind of nice. I think it would be cool to get notifications like that, but don't have an answer.
Okay. Thank you. I'll keep on try to make some modification on the, because routine would go, try to make some modifications on the code and maybe like try to watch for the rollout, but then I think I got it all wrong. It stopped accepting my Slack webhook URL. I don't know, after I packaged my own image. So I guess I will still try to work on that again.
Hmm. Yeah, too bad you can't customize the messages. That'd also be nice. All right. Any other questions?
I just have a fun question. Has anyone tried to put any of the large language models against their internal documentation so that devs will stop asking silly questions? I don't think that it will stop that, but I'm just curious if anyone has done it. I've been thinking of playing with it as a weekend project.
I would love to know the answer. I'm so curious. I'd love to like export Slack and everything.
I've actually been playing around with it and feeding it some stuff using LangChain as the library for that to do it. I've been mildly successful so far, but I've read a bunch of stuff on how I could be more successful. I just haven't had a chance to go try it. Not a lot of free time in the recent past.
What type of data?
I don't want to get you too excited, but it's one of our internal, all of our internal markdown stuff.
Okay.
Interesting. I've been trying to train it on, like, and I started with the Atmos, all the Atmos website stuff. Mm-hmm. So you can ask, like Atmos specific questions.
Wow. That'd be really, really interesting.
Yeah. I've just been, you know, it's a learning experiment in downtime. So I haven't had a lot of time to make too much progress on it yet, but initial indications are pretty good. And the LangChain libraries are super, like, well documented and very popular right now. So I'm pretty happy about that.
Good to know. I'm going to jump on the LangChain train then to make my life easier.
Yeah, it helps with a lot of stuff.
Thanks.
Like, mentally, it breaks down to a retrieval problem, right, Matt? Like, I think that as far as my explorations have been concerned, really it's the semantics. Aside from, like, say, semantic similarity, I've been having some amount of... it seems like the roadblock here mainly is for getting to the right answer. And the only kind of algorithm that I know of is semantic similarity for matching the vector space of the prompt to the documents, or relevant documents rather. What other strategies, you know, have you been playing with?
So essentially I'm taking, like, the GPT-3 or GPT-4 model, and adding, basically enhancing it with the data from Atmos, and then trying to run questions over it about Atmos. That was my like test space in this. And it seems to be doing a pretty good job at, like, answering even some more complex questions so far over that space.
So have you been fine-tuning the model then?
You basically send the model with, like, I forget what it's called. It's called an enhancement, I think. So you essentially, like, summarize all your data, and you can then send that vector basically up to the model, and then it enhances that model with your custom data, basically.
Sounds like you're doing some kind of one-shot as opposed to fine-tuning.
This is going into production next week, right? Or no?
I mean, you set priorities, Eric. I don't know. You tell me. Like, I have a finite number of hours.
Yeah.
I think if you actually look, like, yeah, there it is. It's basically this exact, like, use case that you have. Mm-hmm. You know, chained here.
Interesting. So, like, this here, you would iterate over every markdown file, basically, or?
Yeah, so they actually, instead of a text loader, they actually have, like, a markdown loader, they have a PDF loader, they have, that's why this library is so good. Like, they actually have, loaders, whatever you want to call it. They have functions for vast majority of the things that you need to do to get these kinds of things up and running. And then that's basically what you do. You create a vector store, which is the next thing, which is your index. And then you can, like, send your vector store, like, up to, up to ChatGPT over the, not to ChatGPT, to the OpenAI API. And then you can select which LLM you want to use, and then you pass it your vector, and then you query it, and it does those things.
Okay. So how, I'm totally ignorant on this, like, how large is a vector file for, like, a simple small corpus of documentation like we have?
Yeah, so depending on what you want to do, like, ours is pretty small when it's just all of that kind of stuff. And when you get into, like, you know, large documents and things, it can get kind of large, but you can also then like send subsets and that kind of thing. But once you've, like, once you've created like a snapshot and you send it up, it basically, you only get charged to like create your tuned model basically that gets tuned off of your vector set once, and then you can query that new model basically.
Okay.
So you don't have to send it with every request. Basically, you just have to, you get charged for the full amount of data you send to it the first time, and then all of your queries then like can be sent against your tuned model basically.
I didn't know this was possible with OpenAI, that you could enrich it basically with your own data.
Yeah.
Now, have you fed that, Matt, any code examples or actual repos to further?
I mean, just what's in the actual markdown of the documentation. I mean, this has been a learning exercise for me, so I'm not like by any means claiming to be the expert here on any of this. I'm just saying I've experimented with it specifically for this problem set, and I'm like partway through, so I don't have it fully working yet. So I can only kind of say like, this is what my experience has been. Like to figure out all that crap and to find that I should use LangChain and to figure out like all these, like that all took a long time to just kind of like what I just summarized in 3 minutes took me probably like, you know, 2 weeks of part-time work to figure out, that that's what I needed to do.
So, what's interesting to me about this is it indirectly, it seems like it could almost be some way of validating that documentation is sufficient. Like if you aren't getting reasonable responses, well then maybe we shouldn't expect reasonable responses from humans reading over that same documentation.
Or your other conclusion could be that your model is broken. So yes, maybe.
Yeah. So really no more confidence, but
I mean, you know, you can actually, when you request things, you can actually tune, when you ask it questions, you can actually tune the confidence level that you want it to answer with. So like, I forget what it is. I think it's between like 0 and 1. And like 1 is if you ask the same question over and over again, it will always respond with the same exact answer. And like 0 is you'll get wildly different answers between questions. So it's pretty interesting how you can tune it to kind of give you about the same approximation of what you, what you're looking for. So it's like a creativity index or something like that, which is interesting.
But it includes, since it's still based on OpenAI, it still includes all the, I don't know what you call them, the showstoppers that they seed it with to prevent certain types of answers and things.
Yeah. I mean, it's all, well, yeah.
ChatGPT moderation automatically. But the GPT endpoints, you don't actually need to use the moderation.
Right. It depends. There's still base level moderation built into the models, but it's nowhere near as restrictive as what is on ChatGPT, right? So you got to remember, like ChatGPT is just a web interface that is essentially calling OpenAPI. OpenAI APIs, I don't know, I keep saying that, under the hood to get these answers back. And it's trained, you know, it lets you select which one of their models you want to talk to do those things. There are actually like way more models than you can select in ChatGPT that exist that are better at doing certain types of tasks. And the moderation is far less like way at the bottom than it is, you know, in ChatGPT.
Interesting. All right. Well, check back with us with how it's going.
Yeah.
Anyone have other questions? This is Ask Matt GPT.
I'll send you. I'll post my Venmo here. It's just 3 cents a request, depending on how big your question is.
So, are we allowed to adjust your confidence level before we pay that 3 cents?
Yeah. Yes. Although the call to the confidence level API costs $10.
Oh. Noted.
All right. Well, we got another few minutes here if there's any other questions. Jim, you always have a question.
I don't really have a question. Surprise, surprise. But there is a lot happening in the AI space. It's like a fire hose right now, just taking it all in myself. I've been similarly trying to, because I work for a ebook company, right? I work for Scribd. So, this is a public conversation, so I should not talk about what I've been.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Well, it's safe to say every company out there is looking at some way they can apply GPT to what they do.
Scribd is eliminating all of its authors and it's just going to write all its own books with AI.
I can safely say that's not what's happening over. But suffice it to say, I've been personally very interested in the context problem that Matt has been, and it's all a context problem. Like, at what? How do you bring the context to the right level for the model to interpret? And retrieval is a very interesting problem, and I look forward to hearing from Matt about, you know, what you discover as you continue to develop the thing.
Yeah. Now my fun personal project just got all this pressure put on it because everyone wants to hear status updates. Yeah, I will definitely continue working on it, and I'll let everyone know, and we'll likely I will likely open source whatever I do, so that will be I can point people there once I figured this out.
Very cool. All right. Well, if no other questions, maybe we end a little early. Final call for questions. All right, then. Well, thanks everyone for your participation today. It was really interesting to learn a little bit more about how you can train your own things, thingamabobs with GPT. Thanks, Matt, for that. Also, interesting conversation on Nix. I've already kicked off the process. I think we'll do a little demo here on office hours in the coming week, maybe not next week, but the week after on Nix. So if you've been curious about it, might be a good time to invite some of your fellow team members on your dev team to participate. If you haven't subscribed to our YouTube channel, go to youtube.com/cloudposse to subscribe. We'll post today's session and the other ones on there as well. Great way to keep the rest of your team on the same page. Connect with me on LinkedIn by going to linkedin.com/in/Osterman. I'd love to connect with our entire community here. And if you're curious about Cloud Posse and how we can solve your pain, go to cloudposse.com/quiz. Again, cloudposse.com/quiz. We can rapidly transform the entire way your organization operates on AWS with GitHub Actions, preview environments, GitOps, monitoring, observability, the whole kit and caboodle done in just roughly 2 to 4 weeks. So reach out if you're interested about that. Go to cloudposse.com/quiz. Thanks, everyone. See you all next time, next week, same time, same place.